stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm talking a lot about cover story, undercover, brain chemistry, and why it is that we, all, pretty much all of us, come out of childhood with a very limited version of who we really are. Why it is that we demonstrate, express, only a limited amount of what we have to offer, who we really are, and what we can do about fixing that. Then I'm playing an interview with Linda DeGabriel, who is the managing director of the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And also, I'm playing a song called Hollywood Has Got Her, which speaks about how difficult it is to make a living with an art in this culture. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. Finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from no.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show, as you know if you've been listening, and if you haven't been listening, I'm going to tell you, is about what I believe is the legacy of virtually every childhood that turns into an adult. To say more simply, that each of us comes out of childhood believing that we are less than we are. Each of us has an experience, sometimes many experiences, sometime in our childhood that convinces us beyond a shadow of a doubt that something about us is not okay. This can come in so many ways. You can have a parent who believes that to, you know, the traditional things, you know, big boys don't cry and little girls are seen but not heard. You don't hear those phrases very much anymore, but that doesn't mean that people don't still believe them and still attempt to mold their children along these lines. But there are dozens of ways in which parents can find behaviors, thoughts, actions, reflexes of their children unpleasant, embarrassing, dangerous, difficult. A woman came to see me in her 50s. She was timid, to say the least. She had all these things that she wanted to do, but she was afraid. And when she described her childhood, she told me that before she was born, her parents had a child who died prematurely. Prematurely, well, whenever a child dies, it's pretty premature. And because of that, her parents, especially her mother, was so cautious about her. I remember she told me that her mother forced her always to walk in the sun, refusing to let her ever be in the shade, for fear that she would catch cold and die. So this child, who came into the world with the same amount of curiosity and courage and interest and creativity that the rest of us do, learned to deny it, to pretend she didn't have it. She learned how to pretend that she was never interested in anything that she hadn't already done, anything that didn't come with the approval of her mommy. Now, at 50, she looked back at a life and thought of herself as frightened, as timid, as uncreative, as just, you know, unable to take the slightest risk. Well, what happened to the infant that didn't have these problems? Of course, it was still there. And that's my point. It was still there. Her ability, maybe not, you know, to skydive, but to take risks, to reach out and do things that she hadn't done before, that was still there. And that's my belief. As a psychotherapist, oh, I forgot to say I'm a psychotherapist, right? And so much of the work I do is in recapturing the child that had the whatever it was that we have been in denial for, that had the quality. And I remember this woman, she told me, after we had worked for a while with the child in her, she went clothing shopping, and she took the child with her. She kept it in her head. She asked this child what it wanted to wear, and she came home with clothing that she would never otherwise had bought. And she was just tickled to wear this new clothing, to be beginning to recapture some of who she really always was. I wrote a book about this. It's called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And in the book, I talk about this idea that we carry about who we are. I call it our cover story. And of course, cover story is what a spy uses. And I talk about the fact that it is very much like the spy's cover story. The spy creates a cover story because if the truth were known about he or she, it would be dangerous. Well, that is equally true of us. We create a cover story because there is a danger attached to demonstrating who we really are. The difference between us and spies is that the spies know the cover story is false. The spies know they made it up. We come into adulthood believing that we are the person we've been pretending to be. And so this woman believed herself to be conservative, timid, quiescent, unassertive. And when she wore those new clothes, she found someone different in there. So, I believe that we place these qualities, which didn't work for one reason or another, or had a consequence that we didn't like, undercover. We didn't get rid of them. You can't amputate who you are. You can't exorcise it, but you can bury it. And that's, of course, what we do. We bury those aspects of ourselves which did not work in our childhood. If you had a parent whose self-esteem was based on how well he or she took care, a parent who identified themselves as a caretaker and felt really good and big and strong when they could be taking care of something or someone, and they really got off on having a helpless infant. That little thing needed them, and the need filled their self-esteem. Well, when that little thing began to demonstrate the interest in and capacity to do things for itself, that might very well have frightened, distressed, upset the parent whose self-esteem depended on being a caretaker. And so any attempt to be able to do things for themselves can be met with anything from criticism or a sad face or outright punishment. Some parents go so far as to encourage their children to be sick. You know, when the child is sick, they get lots of care and they get presents and they get loved. And when they're well, they get ignored. This is a lot of where hypochondria comes from. People who think of themselves as sick or easily sick or fragile or, you know, easily damaged, because they learned early on that that brought them what they wanted and needed. And when they were big and strong and independent, that did not bring them what they needed. That brought neglect. So they come to think of themselves as fragile, not well, even when they are perfectly unfragile, perfectly strong, perfectly capable. Now, this is not just that you learn it, but when you learn it, what it means to learn it is that your brain puts together stimulus and response. If you've heard me talk about this before, you know that I think that the brain is the best labor-saving device in the world. Our brain learns what circumstances demand what responses. So if that woman who was timid at 50, when she ran off into the sunshine and rolled around on the grass and her mommy screamed, "No, don't do that, don't go there, no, get out of the sun, go over there in the shade, oh, that's right, sit still, yeah, don't, right?" Well, that little girl's brain learned very quickly to associate shade, delight, exuberance, instinct of joy with "ah!" And the brain fired a neuron whenever that threatened, whenever the sun shone in her eyes, whenever she had the impulse to run down the stairs, whenever any risk raised its possibility, then her brain fired the neuron that said essentially, "Remember, that's dangerous," and dropped a chemical in her bloodstream that felt like fear. and she was afraid. And she believed, because her body was telling her that she was afraid, she believed there was danger, even when there was clearly no danger. You often see this in people who had a dog bite them when they were a kid. Later in life, they have either sort of mild aversion to outright panic about dogs, most of whom are not at all dangerous to them. But their brain sees dog and says, uh-oh, and drops the stay away from that, that's not good, danger, fear chemical. And when we feel afraid, we believe we're in danger. So the brain, with its neural firing and its dropping the chemical in our bloodstream, confirms our early learning and continues to create the response that we had, that we learned when we were kids. If you had a sick parent or an alcoholic parent or a rageaholic parent or a neglectful parent or a workaholic parent, you may have learned that you have to be the one in charge of everything, that you have to be hypervigilant, that you have to watch out, that you have to run the scenario of what might happen all the time. Because the minute that you took your eye off the ball, the minute you weren't paying attention, the sick parent might become more ill. The alcoholic or rageaholic parent might punish or create some kind of terrible situation. The workaholic parent wasn't there, so you had to do it. These people turn into workaholics themselves. And I've had any number of them in my office, because they can't stop, because the minute their body says stop, or their mind says, well, what about a vacation, or their husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend or anybody says, well, my God, aren't you going to take a vacation or come and, you know, come out and have a cup of coffee with me, the brain drops the chemical in the bloodstream that says, don't take your eye off the ball. It's very dangerous. Bad will happen. So, in order to change behaviors learned in childhood, in order to question the cover story, because of course these workaholic people think they have no choice, and they think that's just the way it is. And the people who are afraid think that's just who they are. It isn't. It isn't. The opposite is living undercover in you, but your brain busily creating the chemical which tells you what to feel, what you believe. I'm fond these days of saying that I don't believe there's any such thing as an emotion. There's no such thing as fear or love or rage. It's a chemical in your bloodstream, which you then label with a name. So if you have endorphins in your bloodstream, then you say that you're happy or excited or in love. If it's adrenaline in your bloodstream, you say you're anxious or even excited. The chemical is in your bloodstream. You give it a name, and then you think that that label, that thing, actually exists, but it doesn't. It's a chemical. And we can change our chemistry. That is the thing that so many of us don't know. There are a number of shows that I did early on when I was hosting this show on brain chemistry. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it today. But if you want more information, go to my website, thelinshow.com. And there's a listing on the right-hand side of the website that gives the categories, and one of them will be brain chemistry, and you can click on that and hear what I have had to say. But today, what I'm going to tell you is how you can alter brain chemistry, or how you can begin to alter brain chemistry. It's not quite as easy as you do this and then that'll happen. Remember, what I said is that the brain sees a situation which is the same as, or even just reminiscent of, one that you experienced as a child. it essentially says, oh, I know that. That calls for this. It fires a neuron, and the neuron drops a chemical in your bloodstream, which tells you how to feel about and what to do about that circumstance. All you have to do, although you have to do it seriously and for a long time, is be aware as soon as you can. So you see a dog and you get that terrible feeling in your stomach that says, oh, stay away from that. I don't like that. And you say to yourself, ah, that's a chemical in my bloodstream. Good for me for noticing that there's a chemical in my bloodstream that's telling me to be afraid of the dog. You want to take a day off, but the chemical in your bloodstream says, no, no, you've got all this work, you're never going to finish it, you don't really need to take a day off, you know, much better to get this off out of the way before you do it. And you say to yourself, aha, that's a chemical in my bloodstream telling me that I shouldn't take a day off. Now, if you do this every single time you feel that feeling, and you know what that feeling is, there's a feeling in your body. When the chemical drops in your bloodstream, there's a sinking feeling in your stomach, there's a hunching of your shoulders up by your ears, there's a clenching of your jaw, or your fingers, or your toes, there's a tension in the back of your neck, there's a tightening in your chest and your heart. You know the feeling. So what's important about this is that you have awareness, that you do it as often as you can, and you don't have to do it right at the moment. Later in the day, you can say, oh, gosh, I remember when I saw that dog, I got that sinking feeling in my stomach. That was the chemical. I'm aware of that now. So the most important things, I'm just going to keep repeating this because it's not easy to remember. You have awareness, and then you congratulate yourself on the awareness. The self-congratulations is the most important part. You say, good for me, I noticed it, I saw it, I'm aware of it. This is important because it is the congratulations. When you say to yourself, good for me, your brain drops a different chemical in your bloodstream. If you do this enough, the new chemical will dilute the old chemical. And when the old chemical is sufficiently diluted, then you will not have a knee-jerk reaction, the one you always have had. And new behavior will become possible. And qualities which you have had to bury undercover can become available to you. And your entire image of yourself can shift. So, if there is something that you would like to do, some behavior that you would like to change, something you'd like to do or stop doing, and you are willing to trust me to consider this, when you find yourself experiencing this thing that you can't do, pay attention to your body. Notice where you feel it. Recognize that that feeling, whatever you're calling it, is a chemical. Say to yourself, as soon as you recognize it, oh, that's that chemical. I'm aware of it. Good for me. Because this is a question of quantity. You have to do it over and over and over and over and over in order to dilute the chemical. But if you do it, you'll dilute the chemical and your life will change. Now, if you have questions about this, if you'd like to talk to me about it, my private practice is entirely on the telephone now. And you can reach me by going to the website, thelynshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W. And there's a place to email me. You can read some of the book. There's all kinds of things you can do on the website. But if you want to talk to me about this, please go up on the website and email me. You can also follow me on LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter, where I post the interviews that I do every week, and that's what I want to talk about now. The other thing I do on this show is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because in order to make a life with an art in this world that we live in, it has to be exactly who you are. The taboo against being an artist is so strong in our culture. And you see it over and over again where parents have children who dance or sing or draw or paint, and they love it and they say, oh, that's so sweet and that's so cute, but when the child begins to show interest in doing this with a life, they immediately want to talk about fallback position. What are you going to do for a living? What's your plan B? Are you kidding? Nobody can make a living doing that. And so many of us bury that urge, that need, that drive, that delight, that passion, and live lives of quiet desperation, to quote. But artists, while they may live difficult, insecure lives, they are living the life that is right for them. And that is why I interview them, because when you listen to them, you can hear the passion, the connection, what I like to call the in-syncness, and what I often say, the psychological term for that is congruence. What you hear is what you get. Today, I am completing a series of interviews I did with the Oslo Conservatory Theater Acting School. This is the FSU acting program, which is housed at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And I interviewed six of the graduating class. And also, if you were listening, you heard before I played those interviews, an interview with Andre Malayev-Babel, who was the first-year teacher for these students, and who many of them talk about, both with chagrin about what he asked them to do in their first year, and then with passion and love about what they got from it. And I interviewed the six students who all describe this, the need, the passion, the drive to do what they're doing. And then I interviewed Greg Lemming, who runs the Conservatory Acting School. And today I'm playing an interview with Linda DeGabriel, who is the managing director of the Oslo. The Oslo not only contains the Conservatory Acting School, but the Repertory Theater. And Linda manages that. So you hear with her what you have heard with all of them, this incredible passion. And in Linda's case, you hear that her mother actually tried to get her to have a fallback position. And Linda said she just couldn't do it. She tried, but she just couldn't do it. And I love to hear that, because what that means to me is this deep and complete connection to who she was, and that she hung in with it, she stayed with it, and she's made a wonderful life with it. Now, before I play the interview, I'm going to play a song of mine. It's called Hollywood Has Got Her. And, I was just talking about how difficult we make it for artists in this culture. And that was the genesis of this song. So I'm going to play Hollywood Has Got Her. And then I'm going to play my interview with Linda DeGabriel.
She was Papa's little angel. Mama's pride and joy. She was everything you dreamed she'd be and more. When she danced on the kitchen table and sang her special song, how she made you laugh, she made you all applaud. Now Hollywood has got her, it's tearing her apart, and every time she takes a blow, you come on home to me. But she says she's doing what she must, being who she's gotta be. And she's working as a waitress, she's thinner than a ram, and the word she's most familiar with is no. And although she lives in sunshine land, somehow she's always pale. Oh, she's working hard, she's got nothing to show.
Here with Linda DeGabriel, who is the managing director of the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. We're in a little conference room where I have interviewed lots of people who work here. But Linda, as the guard downstairs, he raised his eyebrows when I said who I was coming to see, and he said, the chief cheese is here, right?
Chief cheese.
Well, I don't think that was, he was better than that, or what he said, but essentially that was what he was saying. So, managing director of the Oslo, do you want to just give a sort of thumbnail job description of what that means?
Well, you know, I think it mostly means that it's my job to help Michael make his vision come true for the theater. That what he envisions as our role in the community, and by community I mean everything from our immediate community to the national theatrical community, is realized.
Wow. what a remarkable thing to be able to say, this is my vision. Help me have it. Help me make it happen. It's pretty remarkable. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it is clear that you are making both your living and your life with the art of theater. So I always ask the same question. How did it begin for you? Did you know as a, well, you certainly didn't know as a young girl that you wanted to be managing director of a theater. That's something most girls, most young kids don't have a concept of what that is. But I'm imagining that you were drawn to, interested in theater, performance, stories. So can you remember way, 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 way back?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Easily. You know, in the beginning, I think it was like many, many kids who, you know, hang the curtain in the basement and along with their siblings and neighbors forced the parents to come and sit and watch. I did all of that along with everybody else. But it never stopped.
Well, how old are we talking about when you were hiding behind the curtain?
Oh, gosh. I imagine it, we were all six, eight, you know,
right.
In that,
okay.
In that
and,
general age.
And you remember the excitement of it, the pleasure of it, the surprise of it, the what?
Anything? Oh, very much the excitement of it. The ability to tell stories, to share stories for an audience that we had worked to put together, however long that took us to put together at the time, I don't remember. But sure, the excitement of having people come in and sit down on the other side of that curtain, and the curtain goes back, and there you are, and you have a story to tell.
Yeah, okay. So I'm imagining that when you thought about it at all, you thought maybe acting. No.
Not necessarily. Partly acting. I mean, I've always enjoyed acting, and I am an equity actor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think putting it together, and as I look back more, I can see where even at a very young age, it was putting it together that was very
exciting
to me.
What do you see when you look back at that?
Well, one of the first things I did, and I think I was probably about 12, I was a Girl Scout at the time, got the Girl Scout magazine, and read about a troop that put a show on, and I went to my elementary school principal and asked if I could borrow the auditorium, which was just a little school, I mean, you know, it's a small thing with a little stage at the end, for a few weeks in the summer, and she said yes, and so I produced a show there. And
I see.
I mean, but we actually sold tickets and people came, and I do have to laugh. I remember going to the drugstore across the street, with whom we all had a very good relationship because that's where we drank our Cherry Cokes, and said, would you print the programs if I put your name on it?
Oh, my God. Nobody then, told you that that's how it's done, but you knew, or you made it up, you invented the wheel?
I don't. You know, it could have been in the Girl Scout story. I don't remember.
Oh, how interesting.
I don't remember. But I don't know if they said that or not, but that's where I
So it's
up.
Quite clear. It was producing. It was putting it together. It was creating it or making it happen, what you're doing for Michael now, right?
I didn't... I wasn't acting in the show.
That was my next question.
No, I directed it and...
directed it?
We actually took it on tour.
Oh, my God. Was it?
Gosh, it was a show about leprechauns and about... the story went back and forth between Ireland and America. And
so if somebody else wrote it, it was a...
Oh, yes, it was a script.
Uh-huh.
It was a script. I wrote to the Girl Scout magazine and asked them to send me the script.
Oh, my goodness.
And they contacted the other Girl Scout group, and they sent the script. I had my first technical malfunction that I remember clearly. I thought it would be so clever to have, when we were doing leprechauns in Ireland, to have dry ice and to have that
the theme, yeah.
Wonderful, you know, mystical experience. And so I put the dry ice in the bottom of a wastebasket and it immediately ate right through the bottom of the wastebasket. I went, oops. So, yeah.
But you were designing, and even then, right? I mean...
Well, design is not among my
skills, what do you call that if it's not? Do you know what I mean?
In the absence of anybody else, sure.
So So if it needs to be done, is that right? Okay, so we have you at 6 as an actor and performer, right? We have you at 12 as a producer and director, right? And so then, I don't know, junior high school, were you in plays?
I did a lot of acting in school. And I was fortunate in that when I went to high school, it was a new school. And so they were taking kids from, I believe, 8th grade to 10th grade, and then each year they moved up a notch. So mm-hmm. then it was 9th grade to 11th grade, and then finally 10th grade to 12th grade. But I was on that bottom group, so I got to sort of be in the high school
first.
And so I was able to do a lot in high school at that point. And then we moved to Fort Lauderdale in my last 2 years, and they didn't have a theater. So I worked with the math teacher who was the head of, you know, she volunteered because there wasn't anybody. There was not any kind of theater program.
So in the school that you were in before, there was actually a theater program, and they did actually do plays.
They did, and it was a fabulous, it was state-of-the-art, brand new.
Right.
School,
mm-hmm.
State-of-the-art theater. It was beautiful. It was amazing, and we had a drama coach, etc. And then I came to Fort Lauderdale, and they didn't have anybody. So I worked with the woman who volunteered to be coach, and we cobbled something together for this.
So do you remember? I mean, I'm just curious. Do you remember saying, Who can do this? Or was this teacher, did she say, I'd like to do this, who would like to volunteer? Do you remember how you found her?
I suspect, and I'm not 100% sure this is exactly how it went, but I think what happened was when I got there, having come out of such an incredible program, I immediately looked around for where's the program.
Right.
I probably went to the school office and said, where's the program?
Right.
And they probably, I didn't enlist her. I'm sure they went around and tried to
right.
find out who would be willing
right.
to do it.
So you're not the only the only kid who volunteered to participate in
it. No. Everybody was excited to have one. It just hadn't existed before. It, too, was a fairly new school, so.
Okay. So you're making this stuff happen all over the place. Right? I mean, really. Okay, so.
Self-interest.
Well, now that's interesting. Clearly, it was self-interest. I mean, clearly, it was always, you're saying it as you know, you're throwing it away and there's a sort of pejorative thing in it, but I think it says what's really true, is that 'twas ever thus, you know, this you needed this thing in your life. And so you were capable of taking advantage of it when it was there and making it happen essentially when it wasn't. That's wonderful. So now you graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming you went to college.
Florida State.
Yeah. Oh, right. And theater, something?
Mm-hmm. Yes, graduated with my degree in theater.
And when you were going through that, mm-hmm. What were you thinking? You were thinking actor, director, writer, producer, anything?
I hadn't tried in any way to focus on one thing over another. I think when I was at FSU, it was very much a generalist sort of thing. They expected to teach you all aspects of theater, and I did everything from hot glue little jewels on costumes to run up and down the ladders and run lights and paint scenery. Stretched the fabrics over the flats, and as well as acting and directing. And I think I'm delighted that that's how it worked, mm-hmm. because even though things like lights and sound are no longer run the way we ran them in college, the technology is 100 times different. It was a great opportunity to really understand just the basics of each aspect of theater. So I was really glad that I got that kind of background.
Well, what I'm thinking is that even if the nuts and bolts of it, the how you do it, mm-hmm. is not anywhere near the same, the importance of it, where it sits in the whole, I can't think of the word, that you had to get
mm-hmm.
from doing it the old-fashioned way,
mm-hmm.
right, right. So, okay, so you get out of FSU, and then what?
My very first job was teaching creative dramatics in a summer program in the north part of Florida. And then I moved to Sarasota, and my first job here in theater was with the Golden Apple. And I performed, and I ran the children's program.
Wow.
And that was a matter of directing, gosh, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 shows over the course of that year for their Saturday children's program.
That was a great job.
I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, you were pretty young. You
yeah,
just
straight
really
out of college.
Yeah. That's a great job. Okay, so then what happened?
Then I got hired by Oslo Rep, mm-hmm. and I've been here ever since.
My God, talk about longevity. I'm assuming you didn't get hired as the managing director.
No.
At whatever, I don't know, 26 or whenever you came here.
No, I was 25 when mm-hmm. I came to Oslo, and I was hired as the assistant to the marketing director.
Oh.
Although at the time, that wasn't even the title, but in essence, that's what she was doing. Yeah.
Wow, so you just sort of stayed here and worked your way up. So you've seen everything that this theater has gone through then.
Well, not everything in that, you know, it really began in 1959, so it got a good start before me, but I've been here a long time.
Well, still, quite a lot has happened. I mean, the theater has had its ups and downs since you've been here. You've seen it struggle and survive.
Right.
Right? Yeah, that's great. And in its way, then, you know, you're kind of the perfect choice. I mean, you've got all of the... You have access to all the skills, even if you can't do them all or wouldn't want to do them all. And you, I mean, I don't know, are there a lot of people who've been here as long as you?
There are several, and were more until just recently. Marianne Wallace is a good example. She was our production stage manager for 40 years, and so she preceded me and only retired last year. Victor Myrick, who is our production manager, mm-hmm. preceded me by several years. Our technical director, David Ferguson, and I came almost the same time. We were actually at FSU together, so we came just about the same time. And there were many who were here for almost as long, but have recently retired or moved on.
So it's a good place to work.
It's a wonderful place to work. There's a great sense of family among the staff at Oslo Rep. And the community is so caring. The board is so caring. It's a remarkable place to work.
Okay, so I'm just curious. So I didn't ask you, but I'd like to run back to the beginning. Did your parents, your family, think this was a good idea? Did they support it? Are they in the business? Did they say, well, what do you have to fall back on, or something like that?
Yes and yes. my father died when I was very young, so he wasn't a part of that. My mother was very supportive. However, because my father had died at such a young age, she was very concerned that I have something to fall back on and wanted very much for me to graduate from college with a teaching degree. I tried. It just wasn't in the cards. I just couldn't go there. You know, it just wasn't part of what I wanted to do. And that's nothing against teachers or teaching. It's just that it just wasn't part of where I was headed. I do have family history in theater. My grandparents were in vaudeville. My mother was very interested in theater, didn't ever do anything other than occasionally, I believe, was active in her college drama program to some extent. It's in the blood. I mean, there's mm-hmm. you know, there's some history, and I have extended family members who are in various bits of the entertainment world as well.
It's real interesting for me personally to hear you say that you know, that your mother was lobbying for that degree and that you tried and that you couldn't do it. And I talk a lot in the show about the fact that I believe that most of us come out of childhood in denial for significant parts of ourselves. And that one of the reasons, well, the reason actually, that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art is because in order to do that, it has to be who you are. this culture does not support any of the arts, you know. Well, of course you know. And so the people who stay in it, who make a life of it, even if they don't make a living doing it, a lot of people make their life of it. It's because over and over again I hear, I couldn't do anything else. It just didn't work for me. I don't know what else I would do. Those words, which for me always mean, I know who I am, and I honor that. And that's the reason that I interview people like you, is so that people who are listening can hear that that's an option, that it is possible to know who you are and to honor it. So so you're a great example. Thank you very much.
Well, I certainly never thought of it consciously that way, but it was always important to me to have it be part of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult for me to visualize having gone a different direction without some kind of intense involvement with theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's clear. And I don't think it's I don't want to say it's not necessarily conscious. I don't think it needs to be conscious at all. I think it's so integral to people who do this that it isn't. They're not sitting there thinking, oh, I have to do this. It's an imperative.
Hmm? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so I always ask, is there anything I didn't ask that I should have? So why don't you think about that for a second?
Nothing comes to mind automatically. I have a fun story to share, however. The first day that I came to work at the theater, excuse me, in marketing, my boss said, go down to the Dwarf Garden, which used to exist in a different place than it is now, in the grounds of the Ringling, because the photographer is down there taking pictures of the children's touring program, which is something that I had been involved with at FSU in my senior year, and then it was taken away from the undergraduate program, and it actually became a professional company. But I was very excited to go down and see it because of my prior involvement. So I went down there, and there is the photographer standing on the other side as the show is done in the round. He's standing on the other side taking pictures, and I'm thinking he's very cute. And we celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary a couple of years ago.
So the Oslo gave you a lot of stuff.
I'll tell you. That was amazing.
Oh, that's lovely.
Amazing.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Okay, the other question I ask is, in a sense, what we're always talking about, and that is, if there's anything that you want to say about what it feels like to have dedicated really an entire life to the theater in one way or another. Anything that jumps to mind about it?
I just feel really blessed, and I genuinely mean that. There are good days and bad days, no matter what your job is, but to be able to work in a field in which you have passion and make that your career is an extraordinary opportunity, and it's certainly what I wish for my girls, that they will have that chance to apply themselves and their energies and resources to something that really means something to them. And I'm thrilled with what has happened. I think Oslo Rep has done an extraordinary job of being a part of this community and part of the greater community. Michael is leading it in a tremendously exciting direction with great growth and potential. And to be part of all that is an amazing thing. I don't know how I could ask for more.
Like a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Linda DeGabriel.
You're welcome.
So yet again, you hear the joy, the pleasure, the satisfaction, the gratitude that she lives a life which is the life she wants to live, that she does a thing that is integral to her, that is who she is, and how she wants this for her children, and how I want it for all of you. It isn't necessary to be an artist, to fall in love with painting or music or theater in order to be who you are. who you are is who you are. Being that person is what brings the pleasure, the joy to our lives. So I hope that that you heard in this interview what I heard. That as a little girl, she knew what felt right to her, and she stayed with it, even against the advice of her mommy and the advice of her culture. She stuck with it, and it has given her the life she wished for. So, as always, I need to thank the indomitable, the dependable, the I couldn't do it without Josh Hackney, who's my IT guy, and who is responsible for however good the sound in this show is, and who fixes everything and tells me how to do everything. And I mean, truly, when, you know, it's a cliche, I couldn't do it without, but in this case, it is also the unvarnished truth. So if you have issues with computers, with recording, with electronics, pretty much anything, you want Josh, and you can get him at my website, where you can also get me, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. And just email me, say, I want Josh, or I want you, or I have a question, or whatever you want to say. And as always, I hope that you got something you can use from this show. Something that interested you, or amused you, or intrigued you. Something that'll bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear I may have gotten